With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
This is the Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo, giving you the inside track on all the big talking points from Goodison Park.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Royal Blue Podcast. I'm Phil Kirkbride, and today joined by Dave Prentice, Sam Carroll, and the returning Gav Buckland as we chew the fat over all the major talking points at Goodison Park. And as ever, another busy week. We were with you on Tuesday, back again after Carlo Ancelotti's press conference this afternoon. And plenty to get our teeth stuck into. Gomez, of course, we spoke about on Tuesday, but significant developments in terms of what the manager thinks since then. We'll preview Arsenal, of course, a meeting again with Mikel Arteta and get the guy's thoughts on him as a manager and how it will go for him at the Emirates. And of course, the big off-field news this week, Everton's planning application for a new stadium at Bramley Moor Dock has been made available to the public on the Liverpool Council website now as we speak, and available for people to sift through. We have done some of the sifting, so we will hopefully bring some of the headlines for you, of course. And of course, we will discuss on the pitch. Sunday's trip to the Emirates is the first of four very interesting looking games in what could potentially shape Everton's European aspirations. Preno, we did discuss at length Gomez and his remarkable recovery on Tuesday, but since we sat down, Carlo Ancelotti has said he wants to start him and feels that when you've returned from such an injury, being on the bench is not the way to go. It's better for a person and a player to prepare to start the game. Would you back the manager on that one?
Carlo clearly doesn't listen to the Royal Blue podcast because argued the case quite convincingly, I thought, that it's a big risk to throw him straight in after 3 months into the intensity of a Premier League game. But maybe what I was also saying in that podcast about the typical Everton fatalistic mentality, always being a little bit, you know, so cautious and nervous, has been swept away by Carlo, and he's being bold, he's being positive, and he's thinking, no, you know, so he's fit, he's ready to go. Why not put him straight back in? I mean, seriously, he sees him on the training pitch. He knows, you know, what kind of mindset he's at. The concern for me was psychological when you've suffered such a serious injury like that and you're foot's been facing in the wrong direction, you know. So how is that going to actually affect you psychologically when you're going in for your first fully fledged tackle, you know? So when your studs maybe get stuck in the turf a little bit, you know, all those kind of things going through your head. Obviously the Everton sports science people will have looked at that, you know, they'll have basically seen how Andre Gomez has been reacting on the training pitch. And they're happy, you know, so they believe that he's ready to get straight back in there. So if they believe he's ready, yes, you have to back the manager's judgment. You know, clearly he doesn't think he's taken any risks. And if you're going to get him up to speed sooner rather than later, I suppose, you know, start him, give him an hour's worth. Concerns me a little bit that he's only played an hour, as you know, behind closed doors friendly. So, you know, match fitness is going to be nothing like what it ought to be. But we've spoken in him many times before what kind of quality the fella has. You know, love him as a midfielder. And, you know, he'll fit quite nicely into the system that Carlo's playing at the moment. So if he feels he's ready, who are we to quibble?
So I think Carlo repeated at his press conference this afternoon that he, again, will have the conversation with Andre. And if the player is confident, he will start him. Put yourself in Andre's shoes. Would you want to start if you come off such a serious injury, you know, 3 month layoff? Would you want to start that first game?
I think probably, yeah, because it almost, it's not like a muscle injury where you might be kind of feeling it or, you know, worried that it might kind of start nagging at you halfway through the game or anything like that, is it? You know, it's I think as Carlo points out today, again, it was a psychological thing as well, isn't it? It'll be interesting, you know, if he does start tomorrow and there's an early kind of tackle to be won or, you know, something like that, how he would react to it. But, you know, Ancelotti doesn't seem to have any kind of problems with that. And I think in my mind it does make sense for both player and manager. You know, at the end of the day, if he's absolutely knackered after the first half, then that's fine and we can change it. But I think there's almost an anticipation if he has to sit on the bench for 60, 70 minutes. And then I think kind of what Preno's saying, there isn't really a point throwing in a player after 3 months out for the last, you know, if you're chasing a goal or you need a bit of spark in midfield, then you've got to get up to the speed of the game midway through, you know what I mean? Where I think Carlo's probably hoping that by putting him in from the start, that comes to him a little bit quicker. You know, at the end of the day, he's played for Barcelona and Valencia and, you know, European competitions and international competitions. He knows what it's all about. He knows what the Premier League's all about. And I think if in his mind he knows that his ankle is 100% solid and he came through that practice game with no issues, as Carlo said, then I don't see any reason why Andre wouldn't be excited to get back out there and, you know, in such a short space of time from the injury. And I just don't think it can be understated if he is fit and he can hit the ground running like he did when he came back from, albeit a totally different injury last time around, last season when we first signed him, then how big a boost that is for Everton, especially in the context of the next four games.
Gav, you know, speak about boosts, and, you know, we use the phrase almost daily, don't we, in this industry, but do you think there would be an emotional, psychological uplift to see him on the pitch on Sunday for the away fans? You know, 2,500 or whatever it is. Do you think the players? Do you think it helps? Not that the team needs refreshing, of course, at this stage, because the form's been really, really good. But after a break, maybe, you know, there could be potential for a lethargic start.
I was just going to say, it feels like a new signing there. Well, think, you know what I mean? But I think it does. I mean, I think there's a couple of things going on there. Certainly, he connects well with supporters, doesn't he? So that's an obvious one with fans, isn't it? I do think, as a team, you'd always want one of your better players in and around the starting 11. I suspect some of Carlo's thinking goes back to maybe what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. You know, we were talking about transfer targets and things like this, and we were saying, like, Carlo's problem is between now and the end of the season, he hasn't got his first choice midfield to look at, and I think he'll want to look at, and as shown already, he'll want to look as many players as possible. So it actually suits Carlo to get Gomez playing as quickly as possible, just to have a look at him and just how he fits into the balance of the midfield and how the midfield can look going forward. I think that's one aspect. And I think the second aspect is we've been playing a mix and match midfield, haven't we, since November, really, 3 months. We don't know how many different combinations we've had there in terms of the midfield too. And I think in that context, the one is sort of best midfielder probably on the pitch. So you can see why Carlo was, quite keen to have that conversation. But having said that, I listened to the podcast on Tuesday, actually, because what Plano said originally. I think it's a bit much maybe to be starting a game. And I do think that these type of injuries, they are psychological, aren't they? I think the physical aspects you can sort of get over, can't you? It's the psychological thing, especially when you're playing centre mid, where you're you're more likely to clash than, say, other parts of the pitch.
You'll just have to keep the ball and not give it to us.
Well, exactly, yeah.
That's what we always do at the Emirates, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it will give everybody a lift, because you want to see probably your best midfielder in the team, don't you?
I got the thoughts of Preno and the lads on Tuesday about partnerships and who should partner Gomez going forward, maybe starting on Sunday. In the edited video that we saw of the behind closed doors game, it looked like he started with Delph in this friendly, and then it was Sigurdsson. Do you think one of those two is currently the best person to partner Gomez? Should he start against Arsenal?
I would say neither. I think Schneiderlin is.
Right.
Because I think he'll... You're playing 4-4-2, you want one of your midfielders to be defensive, you'll just shield the back four, and the other one to play more box-to-box role, which is maybe not Andre's game as well, but he can get up and down the pitch, can't he, far better. You know, he can do it far better than, say, Sigurdsson can. Because I know he spoke about Sigurdsson, didn't he, on Tuesday, to be unsuited to that role. He can probably do it. I mean, Tom Davies can do it to a degree, but you would say the natural partnership would be probably Schneiderlin or Delph. But I'd say to Schneiderlin because he's playing well at the moment, and Gomez is the middle two.
We have done, and we can talk about somebody like Schneiderlin till the cows come home. But Preno, is he once again kind of confusing supporters in that he is playing well at the moment, and as Gav rightly says, he looks more comfortable in that two in a 4-4-2. He's got 12 months left on his deal at the end of the season. If you'd have asked supporters 6-7 weeks ago, I'm convinced the majority would have said, get rid. Yeah. The majority probably still will say, get rid. But is he giving the manager, Marcel Brands, any food for thought?
I'm with the majority. I just don't think he's confusing us. He's showing us exactly what he has done throughout his Everton career, which is little flurries of excellence. And then he'll dip into a trough and he'll go through the motions again. He'll have, a poor run of form. His attitude will be brought into question on a couple of occasions. Maybe I'm being a little bit harsh there. Maybe that is as a result of injuries he's picked up along the way. Maybe he's the kind of player that needs a bit of momentum behind him before he can show his best form. You know, it was form that, you know, convinced Manchester United to fork out a huge sum of money for him not that long ago. But I just think we've seen it before. You know, we've seen these spells where he plays well. And you think, well, okay, you know, do it consistently over, you know, half a season or a season. And yeah, you know, Carlo Ancelotti may be persuaded that you've got a, you know, long-term future. You've also got to look at his age as well. And, you know, he's at an age that doesn't really fit into the model that Marcel Brands is trying to introduce into the club. Players that can be brought in and, if necessary, sold on for a profit, if not, improved significantly so that they're worth quite a lot more. I mean, Morgan Schneiderlin's, you know, value is only ever going to fall, you know, so the longer he stays at Everton. I'm enjoying the football he's playing at the moment, and he is playing very well. Totally with Gav on that. He's probably, I personally would prefer Delph. Sigurdsson, despite me being a Sigurdsson fan, he's not a central midfielder.
No.
And, you know, he's done okay in that role, but, you know, he's not natural there. So, you know, it's either Delph or Schneiderlin for me. And at the moment, Schneiderlin's probably playing fractionally better. And he looks a little bit more, you know, authoritative, a bit more presence about him. But we haven't seen the best of Delph yet. And what flashes we have been decent. I suspect they'll go with Delph at the weekend. And I think that's a partnership we haven't seen yet, obviously. So, you know, so maybe we'll, you know, get a glimpse of that.
Okay, moving on to Sunday's game, trip to the Emirates Stadium, 4:30 kickoff. But particularly, Sam, I want to speak to you about the man in the opposition dugout, the home dugout, Mikel Arteta, player we know ever so well, player that is a Goodison favourite, was excellent whilst at the football club. How do you think he'll fare as a manager?
I think anyone who's worked with Pep Guardiola for a considerable amount of time like he has got a good grounding. And you know, he's obviously got confidence in himself as well, because there seemed to be, you know, obviously a suggestion that maybe they were kind of moulding him to take over from Guardiola when he eventually leaves from City. And you know, he's shown a bit of bottle to take on what is not an easy job. You know, Arsenal are struggling in a similar vein to Everton, with a bit of an identity crisis since Wenger's went, and having it the height that they expected to under Emery, having it the height they expected to when they spent all that money in the summer. So, you know, fair play to Mikel for taking on the job. And it's a weird one, isn't it? I think obviously he was a bit of a hero at Everton, especially for me growing up, and gave us some good times, but left on a sour note, which, you know, back then a lot of our top players seemed to do. So I think now it's all water under the bridge, and you hope that he'll go on to be successful with Arsenal. But now we've got to view Arsenal as direct rivals. You know, Arsenal have probably got a few more bigger names than Everton in the team, but by no means have they got an overall better squad than Everton. And at the start of next season, are probably one of the teams that you've got to think we'll at least have to finish above if we're going to challenge for Europe. So I hope Mikel does okay, but definitely nowhere near as good as Everton.
They've got significantly better attacking options than we've got. And that's, you know, so obviously something that Mikel Arteta was, you know, so delighted to, you know, inherit. I've heard a lot of good things about Mikel Arteta as a coach and as a manager. A lot of people are expressing opinions about what he was like, and, you know, and anybody can work under Pep Guardiola and pick up lessons from that. But everything you hear is very, very impressive about the nature of the coach that he is. He's very forthright. He's very direct. You know, he basically tells people exactly what he wants from them and what he thinks. You know, there's no double dealing. There's no, you know, sort of sugarcoating anything. And it looks like, you know, he's a man who's very, very prepared to try and make a name for himself, you know, so as a coach in his own right. I wish him well in that. I just hope it doesn't, you know, sort of do it at the weekend. Because as you say, you know, we had a lot of you know, fond memories of him at his time at Everton. You know, one of the best football players at the club over the last, like, you know, so 10, 15 years. And we'd like him to do very, very well as a manager. But not starting at the weekend. He's, like I say, he's made a decent enough start. And, you know, he certainly has options that could hurt Everton at the weekend. But I'm just heartened by the fact that they were in action on Thursday night. So it was quite a long trip as well, you know, 4.5 hours or so, you know, so return. So they won't have had a great deal of time to prepare for us, whereas Carlo Ancelotti has had, you know, the entire week to get his squad together. So whether that will play a part, I don't know. It's just, it's always an awkward place to go. Just got one of those places, one of those grounds we never seem to have any good fortune.
We haven't won there yet, have we?
We've never won there. In fact, I was there the last time we won at Arsenal. That was Highbury, 1996.
Six, yeah.
Which is terrifying to think. We've had a couple of near misses, you know, a couple of late goals that Arsenal have scored in that time. But we've never really gone there and looked absolutely authoritative. Once maybe the Gerard Deulofeu.
That's a good game, that. Good game, that.
Yeah, you know, yeah. When we thought, you know, Roberto Martinez had cracked it.
But Sunday's a different proposition, Freno, isn't it? Surely, because for the first time, maybe forever, in that Premier League run, or since the run since we last beat them down there, we would confidently say, well, we're in better shape than they are. They're below us in the table, and with good reason, particularly, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Nothing to fear. I mean, they played last weekend, didn't they, Arsenal, yeah, as well? So they played twice in the last week, and we haven't, you know. So, and they stayed overnight in Greece, which is quite telling, wasn't it, Alain? So, no, absolutely, we should go there with no fear. I mean, Ancelotti, though, you could doubt some of the things that he needed to do perhaps when he came to the club, but like, he's been to the Emirates and won. Mind you, so was Marco Silva, that didn't do anything, but you know. So Ancelotti being in the dugout helps. Played Arsenal 4 times, the Premier League won 3. So, you know, some of the players may not know but how to win there, but the manager does, or how to beat Arsenal regularly. So, you know, that's the strength of Ancelotti. And I see no reason why we can't give a good account of ourselves. I mean, Bob Preno was saying like about their forward options, but Calvert-Lewin, Richarlison have been one of our strengths, haven't they, over the last, this current good run going back to the middle of December. So it's just a slightly different Arsenal. It's interesting going back to Arteta, which when he was at Everton, you know, say, you look back now at that Moyes team, say, late 2000s, and you're saying, who do you think will be managers there? You think, like, you know, your Weirden subs are probably obvious ones. Tim Cahill, probably, you think, you know, big player. I would never have put Arteta in the air.
Football has always
in the management
stakes.
Management
Duncan Ferguson, you'd never have had that as a manager. So sometimes players do surprise you. Andy Hinchcliffe, when he was at the club, you know, basically gave the impression that, you know, football was the last thing on his mind that he wanted to do when he hung up his boots. And there he is, you know, as one of Sky's, like, leading
commentators.
So sometimes players do surprise you. You know, they do have, you know, see changes of opinion, and you know, clearly, well, Mikel Arteta never had, you know, that massive change. I think he always had it in his head, that's what he wanted to be. Yeah. He just never gave that impression to us.
Just when
you've
seen him interviewed, and all his language thing, so he's been in England a lot longer now and stuff like this, but he always seemed to be miserable for one of them, you know, never appeared to be, the most expansive of people, you know, and the language, you know, difficulties there, obviously. But he never struck me as somebody think, oh, yeah, they'll, you know, they'll go into coaching, they'll do great. But obviously, you know, he's obviously got that in him, and you know, he was sort of a technical player that you could imagine him, what a Mikel Arteta team would want to play like if you looked at him as a player. So yeah, I was just surprised when, you know, he started going through the ranks in terms of, you know, coaching and managing. I never saw that coming 10 or 12 years ago.
What were our thoughts when, God, back in December, when we were looking for a permanent manager, and obviously quite clearly Carlo Ancelotti was very high on the shortlist? And obviously, it emerged that Mikel Arteta had been discussed at boardroom level as well. Of course, we're very, very happy with Carlo, and how could we not be? But if we just take you back to that point when we hadn't appointed a new manager, how did the prospect, potentially, of Arteta sit with you guys coming in the dugout at Everton?
I remember speaking to people at, you know, fairly senior positions at the football club, and they thought that it would be a gamble, you know, appointing Mikel Arteta, given the position that Everton were in. You know, clearly, we're very, you know, sort of admiring of, you know, the possibility of him coming, although it seems that, you know, Arsenal were already well down, you know, the route to appointing him. But there was just that niggling fear that it was a manager basically sitting in the dugout for the first time. And okay, you know, so he's learned from the very, very best, but he'd never managed a club before. And given the position that we were in at the time, that would be a gamble. You know, so I think the more experienced option was something they were always going to look for. And I would agree with that entirely. You know, so romantically, yeah, great. It would have been lovely to see Mikel Arteta come in. Not too dissimilar to, you know, the age and the circumstances of Howard Kendall, you know, when he came in 1981. But given where we were in the league and given the need for a run of results very, very quickly, I think a more experienced option was always the preferred, you know, necessity. And we got one of the very best out there. I think we can never underestimate just how fortunate we were that all, you know, everything fell into place at the right time. That, you know, Napoli's president had a brainstorm and decided he didn't want one of Europe's best managers, and, you know, so decided to part company with him. And that Carlo actually fancied, you know, so coming, you know, don't underestimate how well, you know, the Everton, you know, powers that be actually sold the club to him. But I just think he liked the idea of a club where he would have a bit more authority, you know, where he could actually do things that he wanted to do rather than being told by club presidents, you can't do this, you can't do that. So we certainly, I would hope, got the best part of the deal. Mikel Arteta may become an absolutely top-class manager, but at this moment in time, we certainly can't say that, you know, we came out second best in the deal.
I think it's also easy to forget what position we were in. You know, Carlo was kind of almost effortlessly took us up towards the European positions. But, you know, Arsenal, as I said earlier, is still a difficult job at the moment, I think, but they were never really in you would have thought they were not in actual danger of getting relegated, but, you know, Everton were in that relegation zone on the day we sacked Marco Silva. And, you know, although Duncan done an incredible job as well, we were still not clear and dry by any means. So, you know, I think now that you look back, it probably wouldn't have been too attractive to Mikel Arteta to take over a team in that position, and wouldn't have been too attractive to Everton to give the job to someone who'd never worked at that level before. But as Preno says, you know, when you do look back to consider the circumstances and all those kind of blocks that have to fall into place, it almost seems at the moment just a little bit like fate. And yeah.
I think the other thing from Arteta's perspective is Arsenal's turnover being twice as much as Everton's helps, doesn't it? Mm. And the players he inherited, as you're saying, you know, from a coaching perspective. And he's coached there as well before, hasn't he? So it's not as if, you know, he's only ever played for Everton. You know, I think all those things would have made a far more attractive proposition than Everton. And I think what Preno was saying is that they was right. And what the club's attitude, if that was the case, was also right, that he wanted to have a firm, safer pair of hands than where we were as well. So, yeah, I think it did well. It was just, I'm just going back, just surprised.
Okay, before we move on to planning applications, we'll stick with on the field. As I said at the start of the podcast, trip to the Emirates on Sunday is the first of four games, very interesting games. Following the trip to Arsenal, United at home, Chelsea away, and Liverpool at home. Look, we haven't got a crystal ball, but how much do you think the outcome of those four games will shape our European destiny?
I think it'll be absolutely pivotal. You know, it will tell us in a month's time, you know, whether we're going to have an outside chance of pushing for the Champions League, whether Europa League.
So I still struggled when people say that. Seriously,
it is outside. Well, yeah, it's bonkers. You know, UEFA have done us one there, haven't they? You know, so no, I mean, provided no appeals, you know, so, you know, so are successful in the meantime. No, it's going to be absolutely crucial. The first three of those fixtures that you've mentioned are against teams that you'd think, well, okay, they're all tough, understandably so, but equally, they're all very, very inconsistent. I know Arsenal have had a little bit of a run under Mikel Arteta recently, but, you know, Chelsea and Man United have been so up and down, it's, you know, so it's untrue. Whereas we have shown consistency. Admittedly, we've shown consistency against the type of football clubs that we should be beating, we should be getting results against. And now it's Carlo's task to prove that he can do it against sides, you know, in and around us on the table and, you know, sort of slightly higher up than us. And he's certainly capable of doing that. It'll take a big effort, you know, from the players concerned, but they've had, you know, a little bit of a break, you know, so to go again, if you like. So, yeah, it will absolutely shape, you know, so where we are. I think in after the Derby match at Goodison, I think we will know whether we have got a realistic chance of qualifying for Europe, whether it's just going to be a mid-table plod, you know, to the end of the season. But yeah, these next four games are absolutely imperative.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Royal Blue Podcast.
Sam, 12 points up for grabs. How many points would be a good return for you?
You're asking Sammy, the world's most optimistic man. He's going to come 15. Back with at least
15. 15 in a lottery win.
Well, you've got to hope that you beat Manchester United at home. Mm. I think between, if you want to at least be saying you want to stay in the mix for the Champions League and Europa League, you're looking at six and above, aren't you? I think, and that's probably, you know, at the end of the day, whether we like it or not, we're playing currently. We're going to play currently the best team in the world at Goodison Park. But what an opportunity it is to kind of, hopefully, what could still be their first Premier League defeat of the season. You know, we beat Man United 4-0 at home. And again, it sounds weird, but, you know, you'd be disappointed not to beat this Manchester United team at Goodison Park. And I also think, given the seasons they're having, I think you'd be disappointed to not go to Arsenal and get a result, and I think you'd be disappointed not to go to Chelsea and at the very least give them a game, you know, and be competitive against them. You know, it was 0-0 there last season. So, you know, we're going into all these games and there's not one game where you're writing us off like you might have done in recent seasons, but really got to beat Manchester United. You've really got to get something against Chelsea or Arsenal, and then, you know, you're looking for a sneaky win somewhere else. But, you know, I do still genuinely think if you get 6 points from these next four games, then there's a very real chance, because all the other teams around us are still going to drop points. And, you know, whether it's Tottenham or Sheffield United or Wolves, and everyone's still kind of got to play each other. So I think now, at the end of the day, it is just about keeping yourself in the mix, because as we've seen a lot this season, you don't know what's going to happen, and it's not going to take, you know, that season we didn't finish fourth somehow, even though we had 70-odd points. It's not going to be like that this season. So, you know, if you can just get what you can and take a few boxes and keep picking up the points, you just don't know where you're going to find yourself. But for me, the next two games are crucial. I think Arsenal and Manchester United are the two biggest chances to get wins.
I think Sunday's the crucial game, innit? That'll set the agenda.
Yeah.
I mean, saying enough of that, Sam said 6 points, yeah. In points terms, it's more, but actually just avoiding defeat in the first three games.
Yeah.
Is that, I think in a strange way, 5 points might be better than six, because that means you haven't lost to one of you.
Yeah.
You know, rivals.
As it were,
like,
margin,
yeah, you haven't given your rivals a 3 points start. So in a strange way, five is better than six.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's narratives, isn't it? And you know, Plano was saying, you know, Arsenal, Chelsea away. You know, Chelsea's even further back than Arsenal. That's when there, isn't it? You know, and they're not games that we win. And narratives kick in, don't they? So if we get beat on Sunday, we don't do ourselves justice. You're thinking, oh, same old, and then it goes in, like, you know. But if you can get a draw and play well, and, you know, Carlo works his magic and we get a win, all of a sudden, those next two games, you're looking at them completely differently.
I'll tell you what, one opportunity for Carlo to become an absolute hero, to become the first Everton manager to win at the Emirates since 96, the first Everton manager to win at Stamford Bridge since 94, and then to do what we haven't done for 10 years and win a derby match. Yeah. You know, he could become an absolute legend.
It's not as if he hasn't beat Liverpool this season already, is it, as well, you know? But I think Sunday's the big game, innit?
Yeah.
I think avoid defeat on Sunday and take it from there. And even avoiding defeat in the next two matches actually wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. If you could win one of them, great.
Momentum.
Yeah, but one of them would be great. Yeah. And I think, but having said that, all three games are winnable, aren't they? I mean, Arsenal, they've had six league games this year. They've only won two. They've drawn four.
Mm.
You know, so they've been getting points, but they've not been winning games. And so I think they drew two at the Emirates in that time. So I think they're all winnable. We've got to get a forward line, firing all cylinders, keep it tight at the back, you know. Put it this way, if Richarlison, Dominic Calvert-Lewin carry on the way they've been doing, we're in with hell of a chance.
I think at the moment, though, as well, you know, as Preno points out, Arsenal, you know, there's no way the Everton's defenders won't be sitting there over the weekend thinking, bloody hell, we're in for the game this weekend. But at the same time, you know, with the defence that Arsenal have got at the moment, there's no way they're looking forward to playing against Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison. But what Gav is saying is definitely right there. Although it is the ultimate cliche, but a game at a time is probably where it's at for Everton right now, just because there's a feel-good factor, and I know it comes down to timing, but Ancelotti's also done a very good job of, you know, he hasn't really let things get too out of hand. You know, that Newcastle draw was pretty dismal, wasn't it? But he was quite calm about it. You know, we've got that win against Palace. I think the break might have came, even though we won at a right time. And then we've had this Gomez factor as well in terms of him coming back. You know, so there is just a really good feeling around Everton at the moment. So if you beat Arsenal, or at least get a result with Arsenal, and then you're going into playing a pretty weak Manchester United team at Goodison, you know, it snowballs, doesn't it? And if you get to that Liverpool game, as Gav said, unbeaten, I don't even want to know what Goodison will be like on that afternoon, especially if, you know, Everton can get into the game early doors. So it's just so exciting at the moment, but again, it all thingies on. We can't go on Saturday and get beat 2-3-0 like what we have done in the past. It's got to be a performance, and I think now we have to prove, don't we, that it hasn't just been a flash in the pan, and this is a squad that is capable of, at the very least, challenging for the Europa League place.
In the bigger picture, the one advantage is we haven't got Europe, have we? In some of them other clubs are talking about there, which I think will work in our favour in terms of the race for the Europa League. or the Champions League. I thought it was Carlo. It was a good chat thing by Carlo. He said he wants fourth, doesn't he, Carlo?
I think he was dismissing it. We can't just assume
in fifth. Yeah, fifth, he wants fourth. I thought, yeah, okay, I'll have that.
Just on that, Gav, on that muddled look at the minute, because we don't know. Soriano, the chief exec at City, has spoken this week, and he said it's their best hope that a decision, once and for all, after the appeal, will be given by the beginning of the summer. That leaves so little time, potentially, for us, if, say, we finish eighth or we finish fifth, in a state of limbo until then.
Yeah,
I mean, that must be an absolute headache, surely, potentially, on the horizon, because if we finish fifth, we don't know for the Champions League or Europa League. Finish eighth, we don't know if we're in Europe or not.
And well, the eighth, and that's all dependent on League Cup and FA Cup winners fall in the right places, don't they? Yeah, well, the whole thing's a bit of a mess, isn't it, really? And it's a mess for people who are organising it as well, aren't they, really? But I've just got to think, plan at the moment, that just fourth, isn't it? Top four. And the status quo is maintained. That will just play out. Reading between the lines, though, I think they're actually quite confident that it's actually going to be a two-year ban, isn't it? That's sort of some of what people are saying, is that it'll be a two-year ban, which then really puts the cat amongst the pigeons if you finished in fifth. We're owed one in Europe, aren't we?
We must have built up so much
calm. We are owed one in Europe, aren't we?
We're owed a couple in Europe.
And you know, you can't forecast things and stuff, but imagine if he went on the run the end of the season and finished fifth, which we're perfectly capable of. And then, you know, the sort of reverse of what's happened in the past happens. Because that's what the real side don't think has happened in Italy, didn't it? So we're the fifth place got in.
Yeah.
So, you know, the precedence is there. That would be perfect, that wouldn't it?
It would cause immense upheaval to the pre-season program, but you'd take that.
You'd be happy with that upheaval.
Look, we're not where we want to be and haven't been for a long time, but looking at Arsenal and Manchester United, they feel like, you know, understandably, they were winning Premier League titles not so long ago. They feel like they've dropped well off the pace for a number of years. How long do we think, or how many more opportunities, going back to Farhad's window of opportunity, how long do you think that window of opportunity is going to be there to capitalise on the traditional big four, or two of them, being well off the pace?
I was thinking about this the other day, and I think it is quite interesting, especially when you think back of all the times we've kind of missed out. It's almost kind of felt like, you know, every time we've had a good season, everyone else has kind of had a really good season. Like I mentioned before, you know, 70-odd points. The only time I think a team has done that and not finished fourth in the Premier League was us. And then any time there was a kind of a weaker season, like the time Leicester won the league, you know, we were well off the pace. And this time it does kind of feel like there's been a bit of a role reversal in terms of, you know, obviously we've struggled and you could say, well, it's quite frustrating. And if we'd started the season like this, we'd probably be well in fourth now, or at least pretty much guaranteed the Europa League spot. But, you know, the rest of the Premier League has almost waited for us to catch up. But I do genuinely think that you probably get four years max before it kind of comes back around once a team has got a plan in place. You know, it's difficult to say, but, you know, if you look at when Klopp came into Liverpool and kind of had his idea of how to do things, and now that's kind of came to fruition over a 3 to 4 year period. But at the same time, you know, if teams don't get that identity quick enough, then it can take even longer. You know, Manchester United, Chelsea, Arsenal, I think at this moment in time, look an absolute age away from a kind of, at least a sustained Premier League title push, where they'd have that level to do it over two or three seasons. So I genuinely think, again, you know, we're getting Ancelotti in, with Mashiri, with the new stadium, everything could come together, but you need to get that monkey off your back, don't you? You need that first trophy, or you need that first fourth, fifth place finish, and then to do it consistently to then at least cement our place in and around that mix, a little bit like what maybe Tottenham have done over the last couple of seasons. So, you know, this season would be what? At least 18 months ahead of schedule, or 12 months ahead of schedule if we'd done it this season. But it has to be in the next two seasons. Otherwise, I think, again,
you can't predict, though, can you? You just don't know how United are going to fare under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. You know,
he feels like a defeat away from the sack.
Exactly, yeah. You know, he's a manager that hasn't achieved consistency. You know, he's only got that job because of what he did as a player there. So That's very much, you know, sort of a club in progress at the moment. Frank Lampard is an untried manager. We don't know what he's going to do at Chelsea. You know, a lot of people think that Jose Mourinho is like yesterday's man now. And, you know, so he's not had a period of sustained success for a little while. I know he won trophies at Man United. But, you know, so there's three clubs there. And Pep Guardiola, you know, what are Manchester City going to do? You know, so if they are banned from Europe for 2 years, I know Pep said this week that, you know, he's more than happy to stick around and, you know, sort of see the job through. But that's going to impact upon their ability to attract players. You just cannot predict what's going to happen with clubs elsewhere. We've got to get our own ship in order. We've got to make sure that we are picking up points and, you know, putting pressure on those football clubs if they do have wobbles, because you don't know what's going to happen there.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, this. In some respects, our best opportunity is for Man City and Liverpool to carry on winning games, to get 9,500 points every season, because that takes points away from the other... Which is what effectively happened in the last two seasons.
Effectively, you're saying the race for the top four becomes the race for third and fourth.
Yeah. You want City and Liverpool to get 95 to 100 points every season, because that means the other four won't get as many points as what they normally get.
No, you don't ever want that.
Effectively what happened.
Which is what you're saying, but you don't ever want that.
I know, that's what... But if you want to my view, what the best way of doing it is, actually, if you could live with that, because that just takes... It happened last season, it's happened again this season.
There's a Blood Red podcast for you.
Okay, let's say, fell two of that group to get 95 to 100 points. But no, seriously, that's what's happened in the last couple of years. The City and Liverpool have taken the points off everybody else, haven't they? So that other four have got less than what they would normally expect. And that's the easiest way. The more sort of like, you know, the better way of looking at it is, well, it's what we've got to do, isn't it, really? Yeah. Well, that's what the other four are doing. It's how do we get?
Exactly.
How do we get? I mean, 70 points, you think with a couple of players, Ekabam and Gomez, we still don't think is ideal, but defence plays the way it's been doing. If Holgate develops, Calvert-Lewin, Richarlison all develop, we get a couple of players into maybe Wise right in the summer, Pickford retains his form, you say 65 to 70 points is achievable with that squad, especially if other teams are struggling. And you've got Carlo in charge as well. And you're saying there that the top six could be the case, really. So you can't really rely on other people, can you? We've got to do it ourselves.
What it boils down to, isn't it, though, is consistency, isn't it? You know, you look at since Silva came in, you know, we had that decent start, an awful run, a good end. Again this season, you know, an awful run under Silva. But what Ancelotti is managing to do at the moment is bring consistency, and in this Premier League, that's all you really need. You don't have to be exceptional to finish fifth or sixth. You just need to be consistent, beat the teams that you're expected to beat.
Sheffield United.
And do what Sheffield United, and show, like, you know, they've picked up some good points on the road. They've pretty much done what they've been expected to do at home, which is what we weren't doing at the start of the season. And Ancelotti has just shown, I know it's very simple for four of us to sit round table and say it, but at the end of the day, as you're saying, with that squad that we've got, what we've been lacking from them, from an 11 across a period, or, you know, 14, 15 regular players, is that consistency to win the games you're meant to. And that is what gets you fourth, fifth. You know, remember saying a few years back, that's how it kind of started for Liverpool, wasn't it? They kind of made Anfield a fortress. They won the majority of the home games, and then gradually just started learning how to do it away from home, and that for me is pretty much what Ancelotti has set up to do so far. We've won our home games that we should have by Newcastle. We've picked up some good points on the road, and look where it's got us. If we've done that, as you're saying, with an extra two or three players in the summer across the majority of the games next season, then we're going to win the league. It's easy.
Sam picks up a point I was going to raise there, more specific. There's one area, just sort of like looking at like a general point within the club, we've got to improve is the away form. We've not won consecutive away Premier League matches for 4 years. You know, 2016 was the last time we won consecutive away matches.
Is that the start of the season under Koeman?
Koeman.
Sunderland and
West Brom. And, you know, it's that long ago. It's that famous, you can remember the games, you know.
That was when Bolasie looked like the best winger ever.
that has been our problem for the last 3 or 4 years, hasn't it? It's not winning enough away from home against teams that we should have been beating. And if you're looking for us, as Sam said, to go from 55 to 70 points or whatever, it's okay bringing a couple of players, but it's dragging out another 5 or 10 points away from home. More than what we've been doing over the last sort of, well, since Martinez's first season, I would imagine our Ray form has been patchy, to say the least. Mm.
Indeed. Good chat. So final part of the podcast today, and we promised this at the start, a discussion. The planning application is available for public consumption. Reams and reams of documents and pages and texts and pictures and all manner of things. Hugely fascinating. We've only scratched the surface. Of course, one of the headline things to come from it is the capacity of the proposed ground will be 52,888, not 52,000 flat, as we'd sort of been initially led to believe. Chaps, have you had a chance to sift through any of it? Any thoughts? It's all becoming very real, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've only like read the headline stuff that you guys have been ploughing through. I think 51,878 would have been better.
Yeah, symbolically.
What it does for me is just highlights that, yes, it's becoming very real now. You know, it looks like, you know, it's happening. You know, there are actual physical dates, you know, so highlighted now. So everyone's getting, you know, so quite excited. There has been understandable, not scepticism, but, you know, so caution, you know, so supporters have been down planning, not planning applications, but they've been down, you know, so ground move, you know, so movements in the past that have never come to fruition. And this one is significantly further down the line than any of those have ever been. And it looks very, very real when you start hearing numbers, when you start hearing, you know, so planning applications as detailed as the one which has just been submitted. You start getting quite excited about it. And, you know, I've seen people on social media now actually asking questions about how do you get season tickets for the new stadium, which is great. You know, it's what you want to hear. You know, there is a beginning of an upswell of excitement. And that kind of thing can, you know, so infect the whole football club. And suddenly, yeah, everyone's like very excited. When Carlo Ancelotti came in, you know, actually what he spoke about, a new stadium. I liked an interview he gave ahead of the match on television a couple of weeks ago where, you know, what's your dream for the future? And it was to hear the Everton fans singing my song in the new stadium, which is great. You know, that's several years down the line. Yeah, he's already talking optimistically about that. So it does, it just spreads this air of optimism around the football club. And, you know, so planning applications like we've read this week only help that.
I think the dates is what got me, when they're kind of, you know, when they're starting on the south stand and the north stand, the car park and everything around it. And it was kind of saying like when it starts and when it ends. And, you know, I was just sat there for ages looking at it, just like, my God, that's this year. And it all just suddenly seems to be, you know, actually happening now. And obviously, you know, as Preno says, Everton is a club and Everton is a fan base. And, you know, we've obviously had our fingers burnt in the past and had a few near misses with other sites, both popular and unpopular. But this now, okay, you know, there's probably some people who are still, just because of that, will still not believe it until the thing is actually open and there's been a ball kicked around it. But, you know, it is incredible. You know, 3 years, I know, still sounds like a decent amount of time, but it's not really, is it? And I think the only strange kind of thing for me that will obviously be explained at some point is the ground, I think, from the building dates they put out, won't be finished until maybe, like, is it September 2023?
So a bit of clarity on that for people who don't have picked up what Sam's talking about. The club's projections in the planning application, of course, can be subject to change, are that should planning permission come in the summer, a decision is made and the council say, go ahead, get it built, it will take 6 weeks to mobilise, as they say, get the wagons rolling and get everybody in place. And they probably said they wouldn't actually physically start work until the September. And the time frame they've given is 37 months or 3 years, give or take. So, yeah, you're right. In the season that we would hope to be in, actually wouldn't be in until late September. So that would obviously raise the prospect of playing the first few, nominally home games away from home.
Which there's precedent for. Other clubs have done that.
The only thing for me is that, like, you wouldn't have that kind of, you know, the last game of a season playing someone, you know, would be brilliant at Goodison, wouldn't it? But at the same time, I was saying tonight that if it probably wouldn't work out this way, but imagine if, like, the last game at Goodison, it was, no matter what date it was like a mid-season game against, like, Man United or Liverpool or something like that. And, you know, the atmosphere would just be absolutely brilliant, and obviously an emotional day. But, you know, finally now to see, you know, dates and plans and actually something kind of physical now, you know, down, that is when it's going to start. That is, as Preno says, it's just boss, isn't it? And I just finally think that now we can all start getting behind it.
Well, yeah, but there's also the other elements, which is there's only 50-odd visits to Goodison Park remaining now, if everything's on schedule. So cherish every one of them, you know, so just really appreciate, you know, so Goodison Park for what it is and what it has been, you know, because it looks like, you know, it's nearing its end.
Yeah, we could be played last game. It could be a Champions League game against Barcelona, couldn't it? You know, but no, I think it's a pretty smart move by the club having it that date. Because as Sam said, if it said like, okay, the last the safety testing, isn't it? Like, is May 2020, and then think, oh, we'll start off September, you know, August 2023, new stadium, first game, summer'd be great, and blah, blah, and then there's a delay, all of a sudden, it's a bit of an anticlimax, isn't it? Basically, what the club have given themselves is, like I say, 6 to 8 month contingency if it is delayed, which it could be, you know, because they have said in the paperwork that this is the optimum time scale. It could be delayed for lots of different reasons. And so the same, but so that would just mean the first game in 23-24 will be flexibility around that, like it was with Spurs. But I think in terms of, dare I say, hate that phrase, managing expectations, I'm just about to use it, managing expectations of sports, I think that's like a smart way of doing it. There's hundreds of documents. I mean, we went to the presentation the club did as part of the Heritage Society in the summit, which is fantastic. And you just can't, it's only when you see the documents, it reinforces the view that we had on that. It's an enormously complicated thing. A, to build the stadium, but then all the infrastructure around the stadium and the limitations of what you can do and the heritage, which is really great in the documents they're talking about, is put that together. It's complex. And think of it, that's not all the paperwork that's being released this week as well. I think there's some other stuff to come out. And, and it's a massive job. I was looking at some of the smaller prints, and there's a section on the wind.
Yes.
You've seen it, where about they've done wind tunnel testings, haven't they, of the stadium, how to best get shape the stadium to negate the
impact
of the
wind.
And
that's why we saw a slight amendment to the final design from the designs we saw in the summer.
Was it? Yeah,
some buttresses on the south stand, which would be the home end.
Yeah.
They've added in because of the wind testing.
Yeah, which is just shows you, it's just everything has been thought of. And
that's great to hear that level of detail, because I know Liverpool's new main stand, when that was built, because I covered, quite a few games there at that time. And there was an issue there with the wind actually whistling through the main stand. It was absolutely outrageously cold on some evenings. And as a result, a number of fans were very uncomfortable. They started going under the stand at half-time to try and get warm. And it caused, some issues, supporters were discomforted, certainly. And, there was it was very, very unpleasant for them at times. And that was changed fairly quickly. But it sounds like Everton don't even intend to, sort of put that to the risk.
Yeah.
They are going to take.
We're no planning experts, but as Gav rightly says, when you click, if you've got time, and you, obviously we're going to give you some of the headline stuff, but if you take the time to actually click in and go through the stuff, you're left with the impression that quite literally, no stone has been left unturned. It's phenomenal, the amount of detail.
And all the background information about the history of the docks and the heritage and all that type of stuff. It's just fascinating reading it, and all the different options that were considered about where the stadium should fit and what the pros and cons and all of them. But it's all in there. I thought it was... It takes you 10 minutes just looking at the list documents even before you read any of them. There's a couple of things that caught the eye for me. One was the start date being not the start of the season. The other two is there's a thing on safe standing, isn't it?
Yes.
Where there's provision for safe standing, but only on a 1-to-1 ratio. So that means, looking at it, that there's not going to be a capacity increase with safe standing. And the other one which caught me eye, which we had heard of previously, is the amount of premium seating, which is 5,800, which is a hell of a lot.
A jump from what we were saying, Gav.
I think it's about 1,200 or something like that. Yeah. So that's like five times as much premium seating, which for a club of our size, I mean, Tottenham, 62,000 stadium, 150,000 membership. I've got 8,000 premium seats in a really, affluent area, obviously, catchment area. Everton, fan base in terms of membership, a lot less than that. Maybe not the same sort of economic prosperity around here. 5,800 is a hell of a lot. And the club won't be soft. They won't just... I would imagine that's been really well researched as well, in keeping with the rest of the documentation, but that stood out for me, because obviously that's where you're making money, isn't it, modern football, is from the premium seating. It was good to see, I think they mentioned the paperwork, but we have heard them say this is that there's going to be many different levels of premium seating. It's not like four course meal for everybody, and free ale, That's in the press room, isn't it? And,
wait until you see me and my 5,800 mates.
Yeah, absolutely.
Watching from the premium box.
I think the club of those premium seating there's going to be a lot of flexibility there for supporters to take advantage of that. It's not just going to be like 100 and 200 quid a pop, you know. Because when you say hospitality, people just tend to think of like the top end. But hospitality, football grounds, is just being able to get a couple of standing in a, you know, separate bar or something like that. With a, you know, finger food or something like that for an extra 20 quid a game or something. So that was the other figure that stood out a mile for me. And I think that people have criticised the club over the capacity, over being not being ambitious enough, which is a separate story. But 5,800 is very ambitious for me. And hopefully they get the benefit of that.
A couple of other things as well that jumped out. As part of the plan application and making it clear in their argument that Bramley Moor Dock is the only site where Everton can build this stadium, they've scrutinised 50 alternative sites around the city and said why they're not plausible or not accessible or not suitable. And in terms of leaving Goodison, obviously the club have had to make very detailed and extensive explanation as why the redevelopment of Goodison is not suitable, wouldn't bring about the requirements. They talk about adding tiers onto the Bullens and Park End stands. Plus, I think there's a figure of around £20 million has been spent on the last 8-9 years just on maintenance and capital expenditure, as they call it, just to upkeep Goodison.
Yeah. Well, they reckon United's going to cost £200 million to fix Old Trafford, don't they? You know, with all the design faults there. So it's like having a ground, existing ground is an expensive business generally.
You know, it's that Old Trafford.
I've seen the floods, doesn't it? There's a flood at Old Trafford in one of the stands. But going back to that, it's quite interesting saying they'd lose all the roads, wouldn't they? If they, like some of the issues at Anfield, a lot of the roads would go.
We'd have to, yeah.
Some of the main, you know, the main roads around there. So it's obviously a non-starter. But it's in keeping with the rest. It's a massive set of documentation, but nothing has been, literally no stone has been left unturned on this, as we found out when we seen them. Because you can't unturn, you know, you can upturn a stone in the dock, but you've got to keep it there, you know.
But drain it as well.
Yeah.
Just to give, before we move on to predictions as well, I think there was a staggering thing that really sort of illustrated the scale of how Bramley Moor would be. The site on which Goodison is around 3.25 hectares. Bramley Moor is over 8.
Yeah.
So if you think about walking around Goodison,
it's a chest
now,
of a stadium now.
Well, yeah. 2.5 times as big, if not more.
And the club want to take advantage of that extra space, don't they?
Absolutely.
I think it's good to see. Yeah, as Sam said, I think the date is the key thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you see the actual dates and the plan around that, you've got something tangible to sort of hang your hat by, haven't you, really? Rather than just being some intangible thing. It's a concept. You can actually see reality. And 3 years, it is actually not a long time, because it's 3 years since we started in the Bramley Moor pub when it was announced doing the Royal Blue podcast, isn't it? That doesn't seem that long ago. So 3 years will fly over, won't it?
Now I need to start working out. How do you nick your season ticket? Do you just kick it off, or do you take your screwdriver?
Nah, you can't even do that. I mean, the same thing happened at Anfield in the main stand, you know, so fans trying to actually physically take seats with them, and they were prevented from doing so because it causes such a public disorder issue. I don't know. Everton will have looked at that as well, you know, I'm sure, and they will. They'll have a plan in place,
which
will probably big coat on that.
Which will enable people to purchase, you know, sort of seats. Yeah, you know, on a not that much of a tangent, but I've had a couple of emails from people actually asking, because Dan Mice actually, you know, sort of put the suggestion out there, the old Littlewoods clocks, you know, so what's happened to them. And I did a story about this in the Echo a few years ago now. And when they were taken down, one of the contractors actually wanted to take one of them home with him. And the club said, yeah, fine, they're only going to get binned otherwise. So they did. It went to a backyard of somebody's house in Anfield. They tried to get it in the house and up the stairs, and it was so big they couldn't get it around the corner of the stairs. So it ended up in the backyard, and then got blown over in the wind, and it broke. And so there was only literally, you know, hands remaining. But the other one, there was a rumour during the rounds, it was still somewhere at Goodison, it was still underneath the Bullens Road main stands somewhere. So I thought I'd ask a question, you know, last home game, of somebody that would know. Met the head groundsman, said, you're just the man I need to bump into. Oh dear, why, what's up? So I said about this clock, and he goes, oh yeah, it's here. Not sure exactly where, but it is definitely here. We put it somewhere safe. So whether Dan will actually incorporate that in the new stadium, who knows? But a bit of Goodison heritage and history, you know, still exists and could be incorporated.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff on that, isn't there? You know, the heritage side of it, which is great, you know.
Brilliant. So, customary prediction time before we conclude this edition of the podcast. Preno, Arsenal versus Everton on Sunday, 4:30 at the Emirates. What will the score be?
I'm going for a 1-1 draw, which I think will be a good result, good solid result. I'd like to think we can nick it, but Arsenal have got such quality in the forward areas. I just worry about us maybe keeping a clean sheet. But a draw at Arsenal is a decent result. I'm going to go for 1-1.
Sam?
Yeah, I'm not confident for this one, so I can 3-1 Everton.
Do you want to kill a stat?
Yes, always.
Last night,
always.
We haven't kept clean sheets in both league games against Arsenal since 1913.
Wow.
Yeah, 170 years since we did not concede against Arsenal in a league season.
Do you go with that one, Pran?
That's staggering. Yeah. I was just going to throw 69-7. Yeah, yeah, we won on the opening day. What was the score?
2-2-0, wasn't it? Yeah. So, in keeping with the rest of the positive nature of the pod, I'm going with a 1-0 Everton win. And
Making history.
It's not as if we've unlucky where we conceded nil in and like what long period of time they've scored against us, you know, and interesting.
I think I'm with Pran. I think we'll get a 1-1, but I'd be content.
Yeah,
not overjoyed, but content. I think it would maintain the momentum under Carlo and bring us nicely into the home game with United. Chaps, thank you very much for your company. Brilliant, really decent, chunky podcast there. Loads of insight and opinion. And thank you very much for listening. This has been the Royal Blue Podcast.
You've been listening to the Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.